Chapter 13, Sex and Society, and this is part 2. I will continue on here with the discussion of the realities of homosexuality and the damage that it's inflicting upon our society, and I will discuss the destruction of the basic building unit of both our race and our nations, and that, of course, is the family. What could be done to alleviate both their own misery and that of society? For those who begin life biologically normal, the mores and values of our society can affect greatly the adoption of homosexual behavior. The first way to lessen the suffering associated with conditioned homosexual behavior is to change the conditioning itself. If the popular media warned of the consequences of homosexual behavior, and if flagrant homosexuals retreated a bit back into the closet by societal taboo, few biologically normal people, especially at a vulnerable age, would end up experimenting with or adopting such a lifestyle. This would help steer those on the biological sexual margins toward the heterosexual and healthier norm, and far fewer of those without a homosexual brain bias would ever be converted to homosexual behavior. The fact that homosexuality is approved today as a perfectly acceptable lifestyle by educational instruction and by the media makes young people more susceptible to homosexual seduction and orientation. As noted previously, homosexual males certainly have the most sexually predatory and promiscuous behavior of all sexual orientations. Media approval of the degenerate homosexual lifestyle is equivalent to the media promoting the acceptability of drugs, smoking, or drinking to children. The ugly reality is that homosexuality lessens the average lifespan more than casual smoking, drinking, or occasional drug use. One may accept the rights of homosexuals to conduct themselves as they see fit, and I believe the same in their privacy of their own homes. I don't believe in an intrusive government, but certainly society should not foolishly endorse and seemingly embrace such lifestyles as normal and perfectly acceptable. One can understand the homosexual's pain and alienation in a society that is geared toward the heterosexual lifestyle and morality. And one can surely sympathize with the anguish often created from the physical and mental problems that rise from the homosexual's condition. But it makes no sense to lie and say that such a sexual orientation is perfectly normal and healthy. If homosexuality were, in fact, normal, we would not even be here, because heterosexual reproduction is how we survive. We do not shower derision on those afflicted by tuberculosis, but at the same time, we certainly don't tell young people that it's acceptable to adopt a lifestyle that puts them at risk for acquiring that disease. I am sure that there are thoughtful homosexuals who understand why such behavior can never be considered moral in a healthy society. Many who recognize their condition and their limitations can still lead productive and meaningful lives. There are those who do not try to seduce the young into their lifestyle, and who understand why such cannot be tolerated. Many do not attempt to make over the mores and morals of the society to fit their own perverted image or lifestyle. Some find a way to live with their affliction of desires in ways that do not undermine either the health of themselves or of the nation. Those who can live responsibly and tactfully with this condition, we should respect. There is much promise that the biological causes of homosexuality can be alleviated as well. Medicine is rapidly finding ways to detect, treat, and cure illnesses and imperfections of children even while they're still in the womb. Thousands of babies have already been cured of debilitative conditions by such techniques. It is now possible to even monitor the presence of hormones in the expectant mother and in the fetus itself. If a little girl was getting abnormally high levels of testosterone from the mother's medication or diet, such that it would likely cause the female child to be born with freakish male organs or perhaps a male biased brain in a female body, would not any decent-minded person help the mother change her diet or medication so the child will be more normal and healthy? Or suppose a male fetus was getting androgen-blocking hormones that would eventually cause the boy to develop into a stunted form of manhood. And males just cringe to think about that. In which one would have to endure undeveloped, stunted, or malformed male organs and possible sterility. Or suppose the abnormal hormones resulted in a homosexual bias in the child. Would hormone treatment be justified to bring the androgens within a normal range, a healthy range? I cannot imagine how any caring and thoughtful person could answer anything but yes to those questions. I am certain how almost all prospective parents would answer those questions. Now, there will be those who say that by taking such steps that we'd be tantamount to playing God. But try to prevent such a pontificating moralist from taking a laboratory-created medicine that he needs for his own health and well-being, and he'd accuse you of bloody murder. When parents have the option to protect their children, they will. Because of that, I believe that the problems of biologically driven homosexuality, organ abnormality, and sexual deviation will be tremendously lessened in the natural order that will come later in this century. Sometimes it appears that nature seems far away from us in our gleaming steel and concrete cities, but she still stands inexorably in evolutionary judgment over our genotype. Bringing homosexuals out of the closet accompanied by a full flowering of their decadent lifestyle has resulted in the decimation of their own ranks. Decades of the AIDS virus, hepatitis, and other epidemics, as well as gay suicide, will lessen the influence of this group in the future. Genes prone to homosexuality that have been hidden for centuries have been exposed by homosexual intemperance to a new level of vulnerability. These genes are being extinguished in great part by the AIDS virus and other pathogens as unmercifully as wolves cull the impaired from a reindeer herd. In addition to the pathologic enemies of homosexuality, its shameless public promotion has also engendered an intense aversion to it in the new men and women who will make the revolution coming in this century. The epitaph of homosexuality, in part written by AIDS, will forbid it to return to a stylish acceptability in the new natural order of mankind. Even as I write these words, the homosexual counterculture is being decimated by its own incontinence. In the latter years of the 21st century, homosexuality will become far less of a problem than in our decadent period. The next section is inherent sexual differences. As is so often the case, biology prevails even when facing severe environmental obstacles. Men and women differ far more than simply in preferring trousers or skirts. The difference is in the areas of the brain that affect some of the most basic skills, attitudes, behaviors, and preferences. It is true that every difference is not present in every male and every female. But just as some men are smaller than some women, and some women are larger than some men, it is still true that on average, men are physically larger than women. After decades of research and thousands of psychological studies, here are some of the generalities of differences between men and women. they are obviously not representative of every individual man or woman. Men are better at spatial skills, higher mathematics, and map reading. Women are better at language and communication skills, including reading, speech, and writing. Women are better with people, while men are better with things. In fact, men are object-oriented, while women are people-oriented. Men and women have fairly close IQs, with women exceptional in verbal skills, while men show more spatial abilities. Men are better at chess. Women are better at Scrabble. Women are more empathetic and unselfish. Men are more self-centered and result-oriented. Men are oriented to the big picture, better at overall concepts and patterns, and are generally more adventuresome, curious, and risk-taking, while women are more home-oriented, people-oriented, and security-minded. Women are far more law-abiding than men, and men are many times more violent and criminal than women. Men are more likely to make sacrifices of home life for career. Women are more likely to sacrifice career for home life. Most women find meaningful relationships necessary for sexual involvement. Men are more sexually promiscuous. Men are far more sexually obsessed and more often sexual deviant, and have a higher frequency of homosexuals. Men tend to be more dominant, women more submissive. Women are more group-oriented, social beings. Men are more individualistic. Women are more prone to be more truthful, or sometimes truth-bending, while men tend to tell more outright lies. Men are more selfish, more individualistic, and often loners. Women are more altruistic, more group-oriented, and more bonding. Women are more responsive to the auditory and sensory organs. In fact, they hear, smell, taste, and feel more acutely than men, while men are more responsive to visual stimulation and have better depth perception. And by the way, in all these little differences, I have about, a couple dozen citations and quotes from scientific articles and studies that show these differences on average. Men are more single-minded and persistent. Women more easily distracted and diverted by an external stimulus. Men are more skillful drivers than women, but women are more responsible drivers in regard to laws such as speeding and drinking while driving. Women take fewer risks on the road. Next section, women and racial politics. Research has shown that women are far less hostile to outsiders than are males, that they are more empathetic, more giving, and more altruistic. These are wonderful traits when it comes to our own societies, but they're catastrophic in the multiracial quagmires of the modern Western nations. It is critical that women, as well as men, understand that their own best interests are indelibly bound to the survival of their own race and culture. It has always amazed me that the modern women's feminist movement has been politically allied with the non-white activists. Whatever criticism is due Western man in regard to his treatment of women in Western history, and there are certainly faults to be found. In comparison with third world societies, Europeans have been infinitely more benevolent to the welfare and well-being of women. White rights activist Melissa Weaver Prince eloquently points out that the highest attributes of the true feminine character are found in the ideals of Europe. Quote, women must realize that to erase the lines of distinction that have set the races apart for eons would not strengthen, but rather obliterate, the rights and empowerment we have fought so hard to attain." Unquote. Women are far better off in every capacity in the white nations rather than in the dark ones. In the non-white world, women face horrors that Western women can barely contemplate. For instance, millions of women are brutalized and disfigured by female circumcision and infibulation. In many third world nations, women are suppressed to the status of little more than chattel property. Every aspiration of the so-called women's liberation movement would be lost if society shifts from white to non-white rule. Women should look at the epidemic levels of rape committed against them by blacks in America, and this occurs while there is still a white majority infrastructure partially restraining the criminal sexual impulses of black males. Acquainted with the onrushing realities of race, only a masochistic woman could welcome the darkening of America or Europe, and frankly, only a committed woman hater would want such a result. The liberal media in America has clearly appealed to the natural, empathetic, and altruistic instincts of women developed from the evolutionary demands of childbearing and rearing. These natural instincts have been perverted by the media and directed to the minorities in our midst, and indeed to non-Europeans all over the world. Women's kind hearts, for which all of us are thankful for in our mothers, are little defense against those who are incapable of paying back those kindnesses with kindness. Idealistic women, and many men as well, want to believe in a peaceful and harmonious world where everyone has the same talents, the same temperament, the same potential for achievement, and the same capacity for the higher love that they themselves have in their own hearts. They are like lambs under the delusion that lions are vegetarians. There'll always be war, whether or not it's waged on the battlefield or in the boardroom, the political campaign or the struggle for power among the groups that make up oligarchies. The world will always have contesting individuals and contesting groups, and if our genotype is to survive, we must have warriors who will stand up and fight for us. The will to power and dominance is more prevalent in the male. In the less cerebral and more elemental races, that male character trait is unchallenged, raw, and powerful. At present in America and elsewhere, there is racial struggle for the dominance of many aspects of society and on many different levels. If women view their world from their own gentle spirit and reference, rather than understanding that others have an entirely different reference, they will feed a lion who does not see them through the feminine eyes of empathy and love, but as the meal that the gods have laid at his table. Women and childbearing. One of the most tragic consequences of the feminist movement has been, in effect, the genocidal loss of many of the most gifted and talented women in the Western world from passing on their heritage. Feminism, in elevating career and denigrating homemaking, has funneled some of the most intelligent women in the West into careers causing the delay of childbearing and often even barrenness. White women of the highest educational and professional levels are the least prolific women in America. Sterilization, birth control, abortion, late marriage, non-marriage, or exogamy in these gifted women contributes to the devolution of our genotype. By remaining childless, the very genetic treasure that makes these women so outstanding in career and work is lost forever to our people and to the world. Not only does our nation suffer an incalculable genetic loss, but the women themselves suffer a spiritual loss, often not realized until it is biologically too late. Next section, women in the workforce. A whole generation of women has been forced into the workforce, where once almost any wife could choose to work outside the home if she so desired, now she often has little choice in the matter because of economic necessity. For many women, the forced labor is not of the glamorous type portrayed in the establishment Hollywood media. The vast majority are not employed in high-powered professions, but in jobs that often are repetitive, unexciting, and physically exhausting. When the workday is done, they return home to the traditional role of providing the primary care for children and husband. Increasingly, they face the difficult task of single parenting. Although many women, through self-sacrificial effort, have balanced both job and family, many more have found that it's difficult on a long-term basis to fill both roles to her own and her family's satisfaction. The stresses on both husband and wife often sabotage the relationship and hurt the healthy development of children. It must be made possible for women to choose homemaking and child-rearing in the early years of their married lives without economic hardship. No matter the cost, we must ensure this, for there is nothing more important to our society than the healthy and happy family. Nothing is more precious and beautiful than a healthy, happy, and well-educated child. Sex and marriage. I start with a famous little poem. Hogamous, Higamous, man is polygamous. Higamous, Hogamous, woman is monogamous. The opening couplet of this was the insight of William James while experimenting with nitrous oxide. He simply stated something in a flippant way that writers and poets have known since the beginning of time. Science research bears out that it is universally true, and its origin comes more from the genes than from the mores instilled from society. In fact, it appears that the inherent greater promiscuity of the male and more reliable fidelity of the female underlines the social codes that have been called the, quote, double standard. When I was in school, it was still said that if a girl slept around, she was a slut, while if a boy did so, he was just a healthy, red-blooded young man. In 30 years, little has changed despite the concerted effort of feminists to encourage women to be as promiscuous as men. The social scene promulgated after the end of the Second World War attempted to construct a society in the West that was in denial of the natural order bequeathed by our genes. Men and women were treated as though they were potentially identical beings. When men and women are taught that they are identical in needs, desires, perspectives, and actions and behaviors, there can be little tolerance when a spouse does not meet the other's standards or expectations. Why can't he or she understand why this is important to me? He or she must not care. That might be the refrain of a disillusioned spouse. This predicament could be alleviated by the understanding and toleration that might come with knowledge of the inherent differences between the sexes. Chronic frustration often produces extreme agitation and sometimes neurosis. Men and women often try vainly to change one another into their own image. Only when we accept the differences that nature has wrought will more harmony result. That is not only true in families and relationships, but it's true in society as a whole. The interest of girls in faces and people, and the interest of boys in things, carries over to the fact that in sex and relationships, girls are more interested in the relationship part of the equation, and boys are more interested in the sex. One writer explained it by perceptively saying that woman gives sex in exchange for love, and man gives up sex for love. in a clever survey of hundreds of college students, when attractive young survey-taking ladies bluntly offered to take their male respondents back to their apartment to have sex, over 50% of the males said yes. But when attractive young male survey takers bluntly offered the same thing for women respondents, more than 99% said no. The survey took place in the 1980s after decades of so-called women's liberation. Now, can this difference be accounted for simply by the social codes and conditioning? Let's look at the record. Studies of male children whose fetuses in the womb had received large amounts of estrogen or other male hormone blockers are markedly less aggressive than normal males. Males who get larger than normal amounts of male hormone are more aggressive. Studies of overly aggressive individuals reveal that they usually have more ardent sexual drives than the less aggressive. Differences in the brain that produce variations in aggression and sexual drives have an easily understandable evolutionary connection and origin. The nuclear family became the prevalent feature of European and Asian societies while polygamy dominated African tribes. Genetically driven, polygamous behavioral tendencies are more pronounced in the African, but such urges are still present in Europeans and Asian men as well. Extremely cold climates also select for self-control and delayed gratification. In the plentiful days of spring and summer, arduous and demanding preparations must be made for the cold and harsh winter ahead. Momentary pleasures and seductions must be put aside if the tribe and its members are to survive. Emotional control is clearly more evident in Europeans and Asians, contrasted to the undisciplined emotions of the African. And it can also be a major factor in the familial differences between them. Europeans, using reason and self-control, have more natural ability to rein in their libidinous urges for the sake of more abstract objectives. They can delay sexual gratification and evoke behavior that serves their loved ones. Man's genetic nature makes him far more likely to be unfaithful than woman. Yet Western man must continue to use the cerebral areas of the brain rather than submit to the primitive limbic parts of the brain. To do the former is to act in accordance with the evolutionary imperative of the healthy and happy marriage and family. In the white race, it has clearly been our evolutionary path to do so. And even if the ideal is sometimes compromised, it remains the ideal for which we strive. The radical feminist movement has promoted a female equality that consists of lowering the female, the species, to the basest character traits of the male. The early women's movements celebrated the family and acted in every way as guardians of the sanctity and well-being of the family. Movements such as the Women's Christian Temperance Association campaigned against child and woman labor in the sweatshops of America and Europe. They also sought to restrict the societal carnage of alcohol, drugs, prostitution, and even back in the 1920s, recognized the possible risks of smoking. Women's movement pioneers such as Margaret Sanger and many others wrote and spoke of the need for eugenics to improve the quality of the race and lessen numbers who would be born suffering from debilitating mental and physical hereditary conditions. Since the Second World War, the radical feminist movement led by Jewish women such as Betty Friedan, Bella Abzug, and Gloria Steinem, harboring long resentment against Judaic traditions of female dehumanization, created a movement of sexual hatred and envy which they projected on Western society. Instead of raising standards to what was once considered the higher moral level of womanhood, they embraced the basest instincts of the male. They lowered the feminine standards that once made women an island of stability and morality in a churning sea of male sexual aggression. Instead of protecting the home and saving women from the sweatshops and workhouses, feminism has forced women by the millions from the queenship of the home to the serfdom of often menial and unrewarding labor outside of the home, all while the demands of family and children inside the home continued. Instead of endeavoring to encourage men to be responsible in their sexual conduct, modern feminism lowered millions of women to the man's level. And how have women paid for the increased manlike promiscuity? The toll for the violation of her inner nature accounts for millions of unwanted pregnancies and the resulting devastation of abortion. They have paid in the hardship of raising children alone. They have paid in massive epidemics of venereal disease that have often resulted in barrenness. They have paid in the easier access of their married men to available women, and thus even more infidelity and abandonment. They have paid in the highest divorce rate in history, as the once unassailable sanctity of womanhood and motherhood disintegrated, the rate of sexual crimes against women multiplied. In mimicking the once overwhelmingly male behaviors of smoking and drinking, millions of women have suffered disease and damage to their countenance, their beauty, and their bodies, and found a pernicious equality in these addictions and in the pain inflicted by them. Although the gaggle of shrill feminists spout their gospel of equality of men and women, by their adoption of the values and standards of men, they have become ersatz, male chauvinists. Nature has decreed that women can never be as male as males, and that men can never be as females can be. As a whole, women will always be second-rate imitations of men doing men things, while men, of course, will display poor imitations of women's special qualities. As the early women's movement leaders understood, women are absolutely superior to men when doing the things that women do best. It is the radical feminists who decided that the traditional nature of women was inferior, and that the traditional characteristics and role of men were superior. When will we understand that our differences only complement each other, serve each other, enrich each other? What we find attractive in the other sex is precisely the difference between us. Instead of wailing at the differences, should we not celebrate them? Arthur Bryant H. McGill says, "The interlocking of the unique differences between man and woman create a higher being, and that is precisely what a good marriage is." In my childhood, my favorite books were the works of Sir Walter Scott. It was before my adolescence, so I found much appealing in The Courage of the Night and paid little notice to the romantic passages. In high school, I came to love every feature of the truly feminine woman. I dug up my old worn novels and I read them again. I finally realized that in the soul of the knight, there could be no chivalry, no honor, no courage, no sacrifice, none of those ideals without the majesty and the ideal of womanhood to strive for and defend. It was ultimately at the root of what the knight fought for, and what he would even sacrifice his life to defend. It became clear to me that women and men are ultimately simply a different part of each other. In that sacred union between men and women is the family, and in those families is the race, and in that race lies our evolutionary pathway to the stars. America and the entire Western world are rushing headlong to their demise. The destruction of the race that created our civilization, along with the attack on the most elemental unit of that race, the family, can only lead to disaster. In the 1960s, I could see America's fate in the next century as clearly as I see it now in the next century. I wondered then how this calamity could be occurring. It seemed so unnatural for a people to orchestrate their own demise. As I continued my reading, a number of sources suggested that an alien element within our society constituted the driving forces behind these changes. It was organized Jewry. I read a couple of articles that mentioned the fact that radical feminism was led by Jews, along with the civil rights movement. I was appalled at the allegation that, to me, smacked of religious intolerance, and I refused to even consider the idea. Then one day, at the Citizens Council offices in downtown New Orleans, I encountered a very colorful, elderly lady by the name of Maddie Smith, who unknowingly began a whole new period of discovery in my life. We have now gone through Part 1 and Part 2 of My Awakening. We've just completed Part 2, Race and Reality, and now we go to Part 3, called simply The Jewish Question. After The Jewish Question part, which consists of a number of very interesting chapters, I think you'll find, we will go into the part of my activism and the application of these ideas in my life and what I see in terms of the political process and really the unfolding genesis of our people and really of world history and the evolutionary forces at hand for our people's renaissance and really what I believe to be a bright future. If we can find our way to the truth, to be awakened, and to be motivated to make sacrifices for the ideals that are worthy of our lives, our destiny, our fortunes, and our future. Next section, Part 3, The Jewish Question. The first chapter is indeed Chapter 14, The Jewish Question.